Good evening. There's a message in front of me which says, please turn off your cell phone. So I shall do that, and I invite you to do the same. So thank you for being here. The subject of this talk is really very simple. It's about some of the things that Matisse did and said that seem to speak particularly to the 21st century. I'll be mainly referring to what he did in the period of the exhibition upstairs, which concentrates on the years 1913 to 17, where the prelude addressing the half dozen years before that. But I also will be referring to what he said, because I find myself continuing to learn from his words as well as from his works. And we'll hear from some other people, including poets Samuel Beckett, T.S. Eliot, and John Keats, from whom, of course, we also still have a lot to learn. But Matisse is on center stage. So let's begin and look at one of the things that Matisse was doing 99 years ago in the spring of 1911, painting a big picture of about 8.5 by 12.5 feet in size called The Painter's Family. It isn't in the present exhibition, but it was in the Matisse retrospective I organized here in 1992. And when it arrived in New York from St. Petersburg, we discovered to our surprise that it had been painted on striped mattress ticking. And by shining a light on the back of the work, as on this side, we discovered that Matisse had followed the stripes of the canvas when painting the stripes on the front of the surface, and that he'd used the shapes of the stretcher bars to plot out the shape of the fireplace at the center of the picture. So he was an improviser who responded to opportunities. And one of the strongest accounts he made of this responsive method of working came early in 1937, a few months before painting this wonderful picture called The Romanian Blouse, which is at present in Cincinnati. And he said, the reaction at each stage is as important as the subject, for this reaction comes from me and not from my subject. As someone who writes a sentence, reworks it, makes new discoveries, at each stage I reach a balance, a conclusion, and at the next sitting, if I find there's a weakness in the whole, I make my way back into the picture by means of the weakness. I re-enter the breach, and I reconceive the whole. And he's talking about a sort of closed-circuit method of working, judging the correctness of what he made, not by any external criteria, but solely from the reactions that a canvas produced in him while he was working. And this is how he painted both The Painter's Family and The Romanian Blouse. In the earlier work, the shapes provided by the canvas and stretchers motivated the background of the composition. In the later work, he began with a model and then allowed the reworkings to show in many details of the completed work, where the differing treatments across different areas of the surface suggest an assembly of separate discoveries. He used these two approaches to picture making in the 1913-17 period. The former, in a work like The Still Life After Dehim, which allows us to infer that he projected the geometry of the pictorial support onto the surface before he fully developed the picture. The latter method in works like the portrait of Auguste Pellerin, which allows us to infer that starting with the static unity of the sitter, he gradually improvised a dispersal of separate elements of interest up and down the canvas. There isn't a hard and fast distinction between these two approaches, and Matisse used them as he used them, but the former approach draws attention to his starting point, the literal support of the picture, more than does the latter, and the latter draws more attention to what he improvised on the surface than to what he took from the shape of the support. So the former approach is basically deductive, the result deriving from the initial premises, and the latter basically inductive, the result supported by the initial premises, but not necessarily following them. I'm not going to talk about more recent artists, but just to clarify things, the former associates Matisse and Frank Stella, the latter Matisse and de Kooning. In this period, in the 1317 period, we'll find other mainly deductive Stella canvases and other mainly inductive de Kooning canvases. But more often than not, the two approaches are brought together. Now, before going further with the question of pictorial structure, I want to look at another very different set of potential opposites that he brought together in the period: engagement with the art of the past and engagement with the art of the present. First, the past, and a good place to start is the very first interview that Matisse gave to the poet Guillaume Apollinaire in 1907, in which he spoke of how the perilous voyage of discovering his own personality required the subordination of human consciousness to natural unconsciousness, by which he basically meant you have to stop thinking and trust your instincts. And paraphrasing Matisse, Apollinaire continued, "To one who works in this way, the influence of other personalities can do no harm. His certitudes are internal, and the doubts that bother him become the source of his curiosity." And Matisse isn't simply saying, if you have a strong sense of self-identity, you can risk being open to influence. He's saying, you will gain a strong sense of self-identity only if you risk being open to influence. So he says to Apollinaire, I've never avoided the influence of others. I would have considered it cowardice and a lack of sincerity toward myself. I believe that the personality of the artist develops and asserts itself through the struggles it has to go through when pitted against other personalities. He must have been thinking about Cézanne, because the Apollinaire interview was published in December 1907, and an extremely influential memorial exhibition devoted to Cézanne had been held in Paris that October. Moreover, Matisse had been struggling with Cézanne ever since he had purchased one of that artist's Three Bathers compositions in 1899, the work on the left, and this 1903 painting on the right could well be imagined to show one of the Three Bathers having come out of that picture into Matisse's studio, bringing her towel along with her. But Matisse speaks of the personality of the artist struggling not against just one, but many other personalities. And this important lesson in how to be influenced is one that T.S. Eliot made a rule of some 30 years later, saying, a poet cannot help be influenced, Therefore, he should subject himself to as many influences as possible in order to escape from any one influence. And this is just what Matisse did in the year before the Apollinaire interview. He sought to escape Cézanne's influence by subjecting himself to as many as possible in Le Bonheur de Vivre, where he conflates a mass of influences from prehistoric cave art to the work of Ingres, particularly this picture, to the work of Gauguin and many others. And having done that, and then studied the memorial exhibition, he was able to return to Cézanne, as may be seen in the contrast of Le Luxe, completed before the exhibition, and Bathers with a Turtle, begun after the exhibition, indeed begun in the very month of the Apollinaire interview. He returned to Cézanne at an exalted level, conflating the quality of simplification he had learnt with Le Luxe with the gravity of Cézanne's large late Bathers compositions in the exhibition, and particularly this one in Philadelphia, from which the crouching figure feeding the turtle is clearly derived. Eliot also said, on the occasion I quoted, that the perpetual task of poetry is to make old things new, not necessarily to make new things. And this is precisely what Matisse does and will continue to do, culminating with a further making new of the old with Bathers by a River, begun in 1909, the year after Bathers with a Turtle was finished, but not completed until almost a decade later. Now, copying paintings in the Louvre as a student prepared him for working in this way, using standard subjects and compositions that could be set down and then amended, elaborated, or simplified. The student copies were fairly literal, of course, as shown by this copy of Dehaene's Still Life, which was reused in 1915 to make the version we saw earlier. But he continued to make copies, freer copies, in his early years as a mature artist. This copy, after Delacroix's The Abduction of Rebecca, is interestingly a copy on the very subject of the process of copying, his own abduction of Delacroix's abduction, nicely illustrating Eliot's famous words, imitate immature poets, imitate mature poets steal. So often are these words now used in college courses in modern criticism. I couldn't resist showing and wondering whether this recent freer copy of the same scene in The New Yorker is inviting us to think of Rebecca as thinking of Eliot as the mature poet whisks her away. But let's return to Matisse's stealing and observe that he continued to steal in often highly imaginative ways, such as copying the grossly muscled Barberini fawn while composing a female figure, and recalling the chain of circular analogies in Poussin's Eliezer and Rebecca while painting A Remembrance of Morocco. We now live in tolerance of historical amnesia, but history for artists of Matisse's generation was not a chronicle of human devices that had served their purposes and been scrapped, rather a font of continuing possibilities. What's unusual about Matisse, though, is to find an established artist of his generation, or indeed of a more recent generation, stealing just as fully from younger artists as he did in the years after 1913. The radical transformation of bathers by a river, which began in the spring of 1913, this picture shows it in November of that year, opened what would become a 5-year immersion course in various cubisms, in plural, notably those of Picasso and Juan Gris, and some futurisms as well. At times, he showed himself jealous of these artists' successes. At others, professed himself unconvinced of their achievements. And he never was comfortable with the theorizing around cubism. But he refused to rest on his laurels or to close his mind to the options that the younger artists had opened. Most conspicuously, in 1915, he remade the student copy of Dehaene's Still Life using, he said, the methods of modern construction, borrowing from Juan Gris. But while making this painting, he told a critic that he was adding to his early copy everything he had seen since. Everything. And it's indeed an aggregation of different early modern painting techniques displayed across the cubist grid, as if in a shop window, as if asserting that none of these human devices, whether distantly or recently invented, should be thought to have served its turn and be discarded. On the contrary, he asserts that their possibilities have not been exhausted and can be revived within the methods of modern construction. Now, while pondering this subject, I was by coincidence reading a recent New Yorker, one later than the one with the cartoon in it, which had an article on the revival and reinvention of soul music written by Sasha Freer Jones. And remembering what another great poet said, take what you have gathered from coincidence, I took special notice there of something that Milan Kundera had said in an interview with Philip Roth. Kundera had said, "When I hear learned arguments that the novel has exhausted its possibilities, I have precisely the opposite feeling. In the course of its history, the novel missed many of its possibilities." May that not be true of painting as well? In 1913-17, certainly, Matisse was picking up on what he felt to be missed opportunities for painting within cubism. And perhaps the most important missed opportunity that he took up was to engage as a plane of resistance the literal surface on which a painting was composed, as Picasso did, yet also maintain the open, elusive spatiality of that surface. And a good example of this may be seen in the famous relationship between Matisse's Goldfish and Palette and Picasso's Harlequin. And let me start with the Picasso. It's a painting that's all frontality, presenting itself as a tangible, resistant black surface on top of which cogently overlapping planes have been set, as if pasted one above another on a sheet of paper or pinned onto a wall. Picasso's 1912 Papier Collé adumbrated this effect. And when you look at an old photograph like this of one of them before it was flattened out by a collector, you get a very vivid sense of how it is built from back to front. And even, perhaps especially, when you see how Picasso pinned down the applied newspaper element by carrying drawing from the background onto that element, there's a strong sense of the tangible, tactile ground as one literal plane, separate from and prior to whatever is arranged on top of it. Matisse's painting seems even more literal and physical than Picasso's, owing to the ruggedness of the surface. But it does not have a stable, continuous backplane that resembles a sheet of paper or a wall. Of course, we infer that it was built from back to front because it had to have been, but it doesn't thematize that process as Picasso's work does. Rather, it thematizes the very opposite, the front-to-back performance of the viewer before the painting, engaged in fixated looking. Picasso's paintings tend to look at us, Matisse's to invite us to look at them. And to facilitate that invitation, many paintings by Matisse present themselves as not only missing a stable, continuous backplane, but as not having a stable, continuous front surface either. Hence, almost every plane in this work is ambiguous and can be seen as on the surface or as behind the surface, and the big black element crossing the frame allows the suggestion that it could slide laterally like a panel of a sliding door. So the surface talks irregularly in space, with light circulating through and around it. And Matisse's attack on the surface, for what else can we call the mass of scratching and scraping, is how he connects to the source of the luminosity, the white canvas underneath. And in doing so, he connects to the literal surface of the painting. Only it's not the continuous presence it is in Picasso's work, but a sort of ghost presence. It's as if Matisse had somehow delaminated the ground to pull it up into pictorial presence. Even more striking examples of this. View of Notre Dame may resemble a cubist papier-collé, but there's no separation of literal ground and superimposed elements. Rather, Matisse has excavated within a surface that he had loosely laminated in blue paint, excavated his early naturalistic shaping of the subject, and then restated it in a manner that excavates the deductive geometry of the picture. The Italian woman is even more surprising in that he seems to have pulled the epidermis off the surface to drape it over his model's shoulder. In these cases, and there are more, he probes back in order to pull forward, but without compromising the basic front-to-back presentation. He needs that so that a painting will seem to spread out in front of our gaze. And that is another modification that he brought to Cubism. As a typically epigrammatic sentence by Clement Greenberg explained, Picasso's pictures tend to close in on themselves no matter what, and Matisse's to open out no matter what. I'm going to return to this subject later, but now let me move on from Matisse's openness to influence to his openness to change, another way of risking the absence of identity and gaining a strong sense of self-identity. And one of his most vivid statements on this subject appeared in his 1947 illustrated book, Jazz. An artist, he says, must never be a prisoner of himself, prisoner of a style, prisoner of a reputation, prisoner of a success. Didn't the Goncourt brothers write that Japanese artists of the great period changed their names several times during their lives? I liked that. They wanted to protect their freedoms. And within the 1913-17 period of what Stephanie D'Alessandro and I have called radical invention, Matisse often gives the impression of changing identity from picture to picture. And consider, for example, 6 works in the exhibition, all done in a 6-month period between early January and early July of 1914. Pondering this plethora of approaches, Greenberg rightly warned us not to see this as simply a matter of stylistic variety, saying, in a way, it's styleless painting, or at least it doesn't fall into any of the established categories of the 20th century. And added, if ever the continuity and coherence of a man's art were maintained by sheer quality, they were in Matisse's art in those years. I'm not sure what he means here by sheer quality, but if he means intensity of visual imagination, then I would agree with him. And this is never more evident, I think, than with highly ambitious works of the same subject. So let's spend a moment on 2 paintings of Matisse's Paris studio. We could say that the earlier interior with the goldfish on the left is more naturalistic than the later, more cubist goldfish and palette. And yet, this seems a very perfunctory thing to say, relying as it does upon unspoken definitions of what naturalistic and cubist mean. So let's go at it in a different way. Interior with goldfish reveals 2 examples of Matisse's willingness not to tidy up changes he made while painting. And here, I'm going to see if this pointer will do it. Can we see anything? Any mark of this? No. Okay, so we'll rely on you seeing this. One is, if you look at the bottom of the stool, a little table on which the bowl of goldfish stand, you see that he's altered and not tidied up the angle of the trestle of that table. And then if you look behind it into the blue area of the window, you can see that he's painted out, and not painted out completely though, the upper dark transverse bar of the window, the one underneath the red. You can see how it was originally lower and it's been lifted. And he really hasn't done it very well, very tidily, just as he hasn't with the the transverse bar underneath the table. The 2 things are there. And also it reveals his indifference to something very illogical. If you look in the left panel of the window, directly above the goldfish bowl, you'll see that he has extended that warm pink facade all the way down to the bottom of that panel, although by doing so it disconnects from the building to which it logically belongs, which you can see to the right of the vertical. So what's he doing? And I think doing things like this, oh, thank you. I'll point again. As you can see, I was talking about this thing, talking about these changes, and then this, which is brought all the way down, even though it's actually the extensions of this facade here going backwards in, and ideally, logically, it should have stopped here, but he carries it all the way down. So I think they reveal his capacity for disregard, his ability not to be sidetracked by inessentials. I think they exemplify the extent of his opportunism, his ability to respond to every detail produced in the process of painting and make it count to the greater goal. And they speak of how, as he would say in 1937, what I quoted at the beginning, how he made his way back into a picture by means of a weakness, re-entered the breach, and thereby reconceived the whole. What he was doing here was, of course, mimetic. Painting was an art of describing. but what he was doing was also anti-mimetic. He was painting his studio as a receptacle of light, and to which end description and detail could be altered or neglected without thought of any other consequence except making the painting itself a receptacle of light. Goldfish and Pallet, I think, demonstrates this even more clearly. It's a painting which has attracted a lot of attempts to decipher the mysterious remnant at the right-hand side of the painting of the painter with his palette who was originally placed there. But did Matisse expect us to use his picture like this? I actually doubt it. He said it was a reprise of Interior with Goldfish, with a person who has a palette in his hand and who is observing. That ghost of the person observing makes us observe the goldfish bowl far more than the preceding work. As I said a moment ago, it thematizes fixated looking. But what do we see? We see again that the work is mimetic, in that the paint is descriptive of light, and now even more vividly that it's anti-mimetic, in that nothing could be less compatible with imitation than paint actually producing what it describes, paint that itself glows, glimmers, and shines in parts of the picture and fades, darkens, and blackens in others. And as you know from standing in front of this picture in the exhibition or in the MoMA galleries, the range of lights and darks in the painting is legion. And to borrow here Beckett's celebrated praise of James Joyce, I think in front of it you sense Matisse is not writing about something, he is writing something. In the works of this 13 to 17 period, we are shown the means of that writing to an unprecedented degree. His engagement with the anti-mimetic and surprisingly brought with it an explicit engagement with expository process. And this in turn gave greater importance than ever before to his long-standing belief in working by instinct. In 1910, a visitor to his studio, comparing his work to that of the Cubists, suggested that he neglected intelligence, to which Matisse coolly replied, "Quite so, I believe only in instinct. It's the purest, most invulnerable thing, the true life spring of artistic activity." With his serial sculptures, the backs and also the Jeannette heads, we can judge his instinctive reactions to one particular state from the changes that he made in the state that followed. And with many paintings in the exhibition, he lets us see the changes that he made in arriving at the completed composition, providing visible evidence of working by instinct in action. With others, however, the states they went through are only partly visible, but with some of these, notably Beathers by River, the changes are discoverable by technical examination aided by new technologies. And in such cases, many exhibition visitors have understood why we sponsored such examination and have welcomed it. However, a very few fine writers, including at the opposite ends of the critical spectrum, Jed Pearl and Peter Sheldahl, have not. The former believing that we succumb to a fetishizing of process, and the latter confessing to a preference for untutored pleasure. Well, it is true, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. So we would do well to acknowledge the reasonableness of these concerns, both of which speak of discomfort at art not being fully accessible to immediate experience. However, if we are not to be discomforted about the aid to understanding albeit not necessarily to pleasure, provided by other forms of contextual information about Matisse's life, his artistic influences, his market, and so on. It does seem peculiar to want to veto information about how he made his pictures. In preparing this exhibition, we did aim to instruct as well as delight, largely because instruction can actually aid delight, as both Freud and Marx, to their mutual discomfort, agreed. So when fetishizing process is explained as our presenting in the catalogue six distinct states of bathers by a river, as if the five earlier states of the painting actually did exist, the answer is, actually, they did. That was how Matisse worked, in distinct states or stages. His process wasn't so much a continuum in which an image was realized as an iterative and sometimes reiterative series of propositions as to what the image might comprise. And to acknowledge and understand this process is important because this instinctive and amendatory way of working initiated what became the standard method of making modern paintings, including, perhaps most especially, fully abstract modern paintings that bear no other obvious resemblance to Matisse's. Moreover, his working method in this particular period became especially exemplary because he altered his way of proceeding from state to state in one very important respect. With very rare exceptions, he gave up his earlier use of a distinct two-part process, which we see, for example, in Zora in Yellow of 1912. During the first state of that painting, the composition was drawn in a congruent relationship to the shape of the painting support, and during the second, colour was added to the drawing and adjusted until it all seemed to fit together. On January the 19th, 1914, probably while at work on Woman on a High Stool, he explained to the connoisseur and philosopher Matthew Stewart Pritchard, who was in the studio, "Formerly I analysed my paintings and I noted once the design was established, the colour values followed, but now I look at the canvas as a whole, without states." He means without states in the traditional sense of a design state followed by a colouring state. Now every single state is a perilous adventure in instinctive creation. And this is the method that Matisse bequeaths to later artists, and not an easy way of proceeding. As he had written to his wife two years earlier, "To give yourself completely to what you're doing while simultaneously watching yourself do it, that's the hardest of all for those who do work by instinct." It was hard because there weren't any rules. In 1908, Matisse had been criticized for not painting honestly with respect to the ideal and the rules. In his celebrated Notes of a Painter, he replied, actually by offering a traditional rule. In a picture, he wrote, "Every part will be visible and will play its appointed role. Whether it be principal or secondary, a work of art must be harmonious in its entirety." He was restating a familiar emphasis on interlocking pictorial elements so tightly that the dislocation of any part would cause the composition to fall disharmoniously apart. But he concluded by saying, "Rules, however, have no existence outside of individuals," preserving his right to change his mind. Although Notes of a Painter was once reprinted in a book called Theories of Modern Art, it is not a theory at all, but a statement of principles. Not a philosophy antagonistic to contradiction, but a mission statement, a workshop of ideas open to revision. Matisse wasn't interested in theories, and when the philosopher Pritchard tried to get him to speak theoretically, he spoke practically, and when Pritchard wanted to pin him down, he just changed the subject. Besides, he was then revising his principles in his practice and locking the traditional unity of his compositions by introducing dissonances and dislocations. And as a result, Matisse's so-called cubist works break apart to a greater extent than anything in mainstream cubism. And this is especially noticeable in his three great large compositions, each one of which offers itself as a suspended, as itself suspended in a moment of stasis within a sequence of potential movements in time and space. For example, to compare the Moroccans to his compositional sketch for the painting shows that he's pulled the three big compositional pieces away from each other like theatre flats and torqued their three pulls differently, so that the architecture seems ready to slide out to the left, or is it coming in from the left, and the still life to slide to move down towards us, while the figural section on the right appears to pull up and down as well as across, buckling as it does so. And the black that separates also ties these parts together, and tying them together causes them to settle, at least momentarily, in place, ready for their next slow-motion visual adventure in the time of our viewing. Likewise, the components of the piano lesson and Bathers by a River seem poised in activated fields between slow expansion and contraction, separation and combination. In the piano lesson, the strips and shards of colour may be imagined as if magnetized so that they alternatively attract and repulse each other, tipping backward and forward in space while they shift position across the plane of the picture. In the latter, each of the upright panels, in Bathers by a River, may be read either as flat on the surface or as occupying a position in depth in front of or behind adjacent panels. And however we place them visually, we may also infer that they could function as sliding screens that, moving, slide the eye across the picture. I found that to imagine potential movement in these paintings is like walking through a room and registering the effect of parallax, that phenomenon of the apparent displacement of objects in space due to changes in the position of the observer. And I like to think that Matisse, in painting particularly the piano lesson, as he walked through that room where he was painting, recognized the apparent displacement of objects and was attempting to provide something analogous in his painting. Pritchard, the philosopher, tried very hard to pin Matisse down on the subject of whether he was painting the essential reality of an object or its perceptual reality. And finally, Matisse cut him short and said, "I don't see the distinction between reality and the painting." His frustration with Pritchard brings to mind the poet John Keats's frustration almost exactly a century earlier with a civil servant and amateur scholar called Charles Dilke. "This man," Keats said, "cannot feel he has a personality, cannot feel he has a personal identity unless he has made up his mind about everything." And this was the encounter that led Keats to his famous idea of negative capability, which he defined as when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. And Matisse possessed the quality of negative capability to a very high degree, and it served him well. And this capacity of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts served him especially well in the period when all of France lived in uncertainty and doubt, to which fact and reason offered no apparent remedy. And I refer, of course, to his response to World War I. And as I'm coming to the conclusion of this talk, I want to turn to this subject for its bearing on the quality of the imaginative experience offered by his works of this period. It's a difficult subject to approach almost a century later, and especially in the United States. What occurred here 9 years ago this past Saturday provides only a glimpse of what France suffered during World War I. One of the first results of the German invasion was the occupation of Matisse's hometown of Boën-en-Vermandois in the north of France, which meant that the artist's brother, Auguste, and hundreds of other men in the town were deported to a prison camp in Germany, leaving his 70-year-old mother, Anna, alone in failing health. Matisse volunteered for military duty and purchased boots in anticipation of serving, but was rejected owing to his age, he was 44, and weak heart. However, many of his friends and colleagues served, among them his close friends, the painters Charles Camoin and Albert Marquet, as well as Apollinaire and Georges Braque, both of whom were badly wounded and returned as war heroes. Others were successful in escaping service, Robert Delaunay fleeing to Switzerland and Marcel Duchamp to the United States. And we must forget the honours claimed by many of those who refused the draft during the Vietnam War if we are to understand the dishonour attributed to those who did so in 1914. Matisse, we know, was deeply upset, disappointed and ashamed at not directly serving his country. He sold prints in order to send what he said was 100 kilos of bread every week to the prisoners at risk of dying from hunger in Germany, buying each week what I've calculated must have been 500 baguettes was no mean task during wartime, but of course it didn't answer the much larger question. It was impossible for Matisse to conceive of making war posters like Dufy did, or making paintings of battlefields as Félix Valentin did. And speaking for himself, he would write in 1951, despite pressures from certain conventional quarters, the war didn't influence the subject of paintings, for we were no longer merely painting subjects. For those who could work, there was only a restriction of means. He reacted to the privations of the war by a self-imposed restriction of means, making do with less in his art as well as in his life. This response, which was ethical as well as pictorial, I think only increased the intensity of what he achieved. He refused ostentation in his personal and public life, including refusing to draw attention to himself by having solo exhibitions in Paris while his compatriots were in arms. And even as the Cubists, following his own earlier lead, were enriching the colour of their works in 1914, he refused ostentation in his art too. However, we must obviously resist the equation that dark paint stands for dark times. And if we take Matisse at his word that the war did not influence the subject of paintings, we also must resist, didn't we have this before? I'm sorry, I didn't jump ahead enough. Cubists and Matisse, there we go. And I think we also have to resist an interpretation that has been made of Bethes by River, that this painting, which he conceived as an imagination of a leisurely Arcadia, this is the 1909 watercolour recording, his first idea for the painting, how this became it's been suggested, an actual allegory of the results of the war. However, we have learnt from the wonderful book by Paul Fussell, The Great War and Modern Memory, that World War I, far more than any previous war, was understood to be a war in and against nature as well as between unimaginably large armies. While Bathers by a River refuses to be so commonplace a thing as an allegory, the impossibility, owing to the war, to credibly picture a golden age of pleasure is surely one of its strongest intimations, and the possibility of doing so is another. As Fussell noted, if the opposite of war is peace, the opposite of experiencing moments of war is proposing moments of pastoral. And in this respect, technical examination has been of critical importance in showing that Matisse finally set this picture on the path to its conclusion when he placed a black band down the centre, a band that both divides and unifies what then developed into contrasting verdant and barren zones each side of this band and a sign for a serpent rising between them. Remembering what Beckett said of Joyce, we might say that Matisse is not painting about something, the war, but he is painting something. He is painting something divided, unfinished, uncertain, and incomplete, qualities that he as an individual shares with his times and shares with us by showing them. He shows us, this is Beckett again, the sense which is ever rising to the surface of the form and beginning the form itself. That's to say, Matisse resists finalizing statement while registering the forming of statement, and keeping a picture in flux keeps it poised in a state of contrary implications. The black divides and it joins, and what is unfinished is all the more open to the viewer's pleasurable completion. In words that are highly pertinent to this painter, the critic Lionel Trilling said this of the poet Keats. Keats, then, he said, may be thought of as the poet who made the boldest affirmation of the principle of pleasure, and also as the poet who brought the principle of pleasure into the greatest and sincerest doubts. Matisse's wartime paintings may be said to invite us to ponder the manner in which the desire for pleasure denies itself by being surrounded, as Trilling puts it, by what on earth denies it, by darkness, cold, and death, which make it transitory, which make the felt and proclaimed reality mere illusion. But this intimation of the illusory isn't offered as a challenge to pleasure, rather as an inherent challenge of pleasure, of all pleasure. Matisse was deeply conscious of the contrariness of pleasure, that there are some things about it that aren't pleasurable, but cloying and satiating and should be avoided. And there are many sensations that are not pleasurable at all, but painful and disturbing, and yet may be among the intimations of an art in which we can rejoice. And the uneasiness and the majesty of Bathers by a River are not contradictory, but complementary intimations. And if this great work may be thought to tell of an infected Eden, it also, I believe, may be used to gain qualities of liberation and delight. Then in 1917, something changed. For 5 years, he had struggled to mend continuity through change, and now he used change to break continuity. And the first unequivocal indication of this is when he painted the music lesson, a reprise of the previous year's piano lesson, and previously the more freely painted, more naturalistic work had preceded the more deliberated, more abstracted, and now Matisse reversed himself, alarm bells starting to go off among his supporters. And when he moved to Nice at the end of 1917, the more intimate works that followed were condemned by many avant-garde critics and continue to be condescended to as evidence that Matisse merely surrendered to pleasure and naturalism, thereby stepping off the true path of modernist progress. But as I hope I've made clear, Matisse would never support any rule about where art should go, especially a historicist theory that erected immutable laws over human agency, nor would he ever esteem abstraction as a goal, only as one of the weapons in his anti-mimetic arsenal. Even if we do believe that in the Nice period Matisse was neither as great nor as radical an artist, not necessarily the same thing as before, we must surely honour him for not having gone into production, not for having become a prisoner of success, a prisoner of style, a prisoner of the avant-garde. And typically, he was very, very clear about what he was doing. Writing, "When you have achieved what you want to do in a certain area, when you have exploited the possibilities that lie in one direction, you must, when the time comes, change course, search for something new. If I had continued down the other road, which I know so well, I would have ended up as a mannerist. One must always keep one's eye, one's feeling fresh. One must always follow one's instincts." Thank you very much indeed. So I've spoken a little longer than I'd intended to, but if there are any people who would like to ask any questions, I will attempt to, if not answer them, to respond to them anyhow. I'm
just going to ask you to speak. Thank you. First, let me thank you for complexifying both our view of Matisse the man and his work. It was really very stimulating. Thank you. I have a strange question. I recently saw a wonderful Rothko exhibition at the National Gallery. In the tower, they have, I think it's 6 or 8 of his black paintings, Rothko's black paintings. And in one of the statements in the brochure surrounding that exhibition, he says he was influenced by Matisse's window painting, the one with the black strip in the middle.
Yeah.
I was puzzled because of something I read about that, namely that it was not exhibited in public until something like 1966.
Yep, that's correct.
The black paintings were 1964, so that left me very puzzled.
Well, I think you are right to be puzzled, and you've answered your question. There's no way he could have seen a painting not exhibited until 1966.
Could he have seen it in a private collection?
No, Matisse kept it all his life, and it was in one of his studios, after his death. And from 1954 to 1966, it was in the possession of his daughter Marguerite, and I am certain that Rothko did not visit Marguerite de Thouy.
Thank you.
So, one more question of influence disappears, right?
First of all, I want to. I saw your show with Charlie Rose, and I think it was a great discussion on Matisse's work. Compliment you and Stephanie on it. I have a question, and I have a problem with the word instinct. My understanding of the word instinct, it's predictable behavior. And I think I'm wondering if the word intuition would have been more appropriate. And I don't know if it was a miss how Matisse referred to that word, or maybe it was lost in translation. But it's very hard for me to understand the word instinct when it comes to a creative artist.
Well,
where intuition I think is much more appropriate. And I'd just like to, if you could expound on that. And,
Well, he did use both words. He talked a lot about intuition. But, you know, I think when he spoke about instinct, he didn't think of it as instinct being the movement to instinct may be predictable because it's but actually what is produced by instinct is not predictable. And I think that's what he was talking about, that he was reacting instinctively to what he saw on the canvas. And he was actually looking at his work as he went along and reacting to parts of it and what he felt worked. And obviously intuition and instinct are, you know, kind of overlapping things. I think of intuition being a kind of manicured lawn and instinct being a sort of rather rougher terrain. And I think that Matisse was willing to work in either kind of geography as he worked.
Did he really, in fact, deny intellectualism?
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's hard to believe because of his compositions are so magnificently thought out.
They're instinctively produced.
I'd rather say intuitively produced. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, if anybody would like to ask questions directly to me rather than in front of everybody else, they're very welcome to. And thank you so much for coming.